This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 13 for Thursday, June 25th, 2009, Dame Diesel. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outoflinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Music Store.
Welcome to another edition of Out of Line After Hours. It's great that you're joining us here. And of course, as always, we have Jason Vines here with us. Jason, say something so in the podcast version they know that you're really here and I'm not making it up.
I'm here on the weirdest day in America.
Why is it so weird?
Farrah Fawcett, who everybody in my generation, our generation, had their poster of her, number one selling poster.
Or even if they didn't have it, they know the poster you're talking about.
And then an hour and a half ago, Michael Jackson dies. This is a weird day.
Yeah.
It's one of those weird days.
And, of course, joining us, too, is Peter DeLorenzo, Mr. Auto Extremist himself.
Hey, John. Good evening. Glad to be here again.
Yeah, and we'll have to get into some of the stuff that you've got on your website this week, too. But also, our special guest joining us via Skype is Denise McCluggage. Denise, thanks for Skyping in from Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Hi. Am I cleared for takeoff?
You are, loud and clear.
Cool.
So, Denise, in case anybody watching isn't familiar with your background, you've been what, a race car driver? You've been a journalist writing about all kinds of things. You're a columnist with AutoWeek. I'm missing other things, right?
I don't know. I kind of been at it long enough to forget most of it.
Actually, Ben, my producer, and I were trying to find things about you that we might be able to show the audience tonight. And I don't know if you'll recognize this or not. You're probably totally familiar with it. But, Ben, do we have that clip? Can we run that now?
I, Denise McCluggage, am a sports writer for the New York Herald Tribune. Under my own byline, I cover mostly skiing and sports car racing. I am proficient in both sports. For a time, I was a ski instructor and have also skied in competition here in the United States. I own and publish a semi-monthly newspaper on sports car racing and have owned and raced several cars of my own. I have raced in competition all over the United States as well as in South America and Europe. Next month, for the second year in a row, I will drive a car in the famous 12-hour endurance race at Sebring, Florida. Signed, Denise McCluggage. There we have it now. Let's find out whether we're right or wrong as we discover which one of these three equally charming ladies is the real sports writer and racer. So will the real Denise McCluggage please stand up?
That's cool.
Yeah, Denise, you must remember that like it was yesterday.
Yes, it was indeed just yesterday.
Did you know that's online?
Yeah, well, someone told me it was on YouTube.
It is.
And I allowed it how it probably was. Everything else is.
Now, a lot of people the audience in our age group, probably not the younger group, there's a other trivia piece about who Denise was married to for, I believe, 2 years. Am I right, Michael? Was 2 years?
I was married to him for 11 months.
11 months.
Yeah, and I outlasted several others.
Yes, and was it Michael Crane?
Conrad,
who was the guy on Hill Street Blues that started every show that said, "Be careful out there."
I did not know that.
You did not know that?
I did not know that.
Am I right, Denise?
Yes, that's true. That is indeed true.
11 months, so good for you.
Yeah. Well, the next one only lasted 8 months. So.
Wait a minute. Do I discern a pattern here?
No, that was his next wife. I decided I was not very good at that sort of thing, and so I. It's nice to have an ex-husband. Actually.
I apologize for sharing that trivia, but it's kind of a cool trivia point.
Well, let's talk about some of the stuff going on in the industry right now. And Jason, I know one of the things that you wanted to get into is the news that broke that Tesla, this little electric car company, is getting nearly $500 million from the government.
That was actually Peter, but I'll comment.
Okay.
They're getting $450 million or whatever.
$465 million.
You know, they've got the Roadster. As Peter says, grossly overpriced. Whether or not they can bring out the S model, their new sedan, and expand beyond that, that's the key. So we'll see if that money is useful. You know, Peter was really down on giving them money, saying they're fake. If they can pull it off with the S model and beyond, well, if you're going to give money to Chrysler and Ford, or Chrysler and GM, give money to Tesla, but jury's still out.
They're a kit car manufacturer who hit the mother load. And the people involved in them are already wealthy. So it was just kind of, it just didn't sit well with me.
Well, you know, they're going to make, I think, 1,600 cars this year at 100 and whatever plus thousand each. And yeah, they will bring out this S model that they're saying is only going to cost $50,000. But boy, I'm sort of curious how, obviously, a wealthy, politically well-connected company can
obviously
make some. Denise, what do you make of that? Of Tesla getting $500 million?
It's more than I make in a week, I tell you. They originally were going to build their plant in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And then California offered them some incentives, and so they went off there. They're a flighty bunch. They go wherever there's money. And I don't blame them. I mean, it's a lot, though. I mean, particularly since the sedan has not been seen, has it? I mean, has anyone driven the sedan?
No, they've got one sort of concept/prototype model that they rolled out, but, you know, outside of anybody in the company, no one's been in that car.
Is that the car that Fisker designed before he left?
Well,
or was Fisker involved in that?
Well, I don't think so.
Did they contract Fisker to do it? They've got isn't there a big falling out?
There was a lawsuit between the two.
Lawsuits going on, I think.
No, there's a guy named Franz von Holzhausen now, who's at Tesla, and I believe Franz is the guy who pretty much designed this car.
But the suit is between Tesla and Fisker because they're claiming Fisker ripped off their sedan.
I thought it had to do more on the technology
side. There's a suit between Elon Musk and the original founder.
Yeah, that's another suit.
That's a different suit, yeah.
This is going to be a purpose-built car, their first one from the ground up. The Roadster right now is from Lotus. So it's a glider that they get. And if they can do well with that, we'll see. They want to be a full-line manufacturer. I'm not sure what that means.
Well,
SUVs?
I'm not sure what it means, but for them, what full line would mean. But, you know, I interviewed Elon Musk earlier this year. They were in town for the Detroit Auto Show, and I said to him, I don't see how you guys can make any money. I mean, explain your business case to me. You know, you're going to make 1,600 cars this year. You know, okay, so maybe you get to a few thousand when you get the Model S. And he says, he says, you have to understand, this isn't a business. This is a cause. And I said, well, that explains everything then. And that's how he's approaching it. He wants to turn the world into one that uses electric cars. And if they make money, that's great.
I'd rather give Paul Wilbur like $30 million to see what he does with that with Aptera than give Tesla $465.
Right. Well, Peter, what do you make of Nissan getting $1.6 billion to build electric cars in Tennessee?
Well, Carlos Ghosn has made a huge bet in electric cars. I mean, and they made that bet almost 3 years ago. And I remember hearing about it, and I couldn't believe it, but it's for real. And, you know, I guess they're going to convert the plant in Smyrna, Tennessee for it, and they're betting big on urban city electric cars. So,
And he was a guy that said hybrids were crap.
Yeah, but these are fully electric. These are full electric.
I realize that, but, I mean, to say they're hybrids are crap, which he said about 5 years ago,
yeah,
and say EVs are the way, wow, that's...
Yeah.
Well, I hope that someone's making very long extension cords.
Well, it's clear to me. I mean, no one's really thinking about this power grid thing. And, you know, a reader emailed me and said, what am I supposed to do in New York? You know, my car's out in the street out there. What am I going to do there? And I said, well, there's probably going to be a push to put little electric meters all over cities and towns all over the country, and you'll be paying for them. So good luck
right.
with that.
And while we have people stealing copper and catalytic converters, they're going to be stealing this crap, too,
yeah,
when it's on the street. So get ready for this.
And, Denise, you know, all this money's being poured into electric cars and green cars, but I know you're a huge proponent of diesel, and doesn't sound like the government's doing much of anything along those lines.
Yeah, I don't understand it, really, because, I mean, diesel is hardly the answer for the future, but it is certainly the ideal transition because it stretches what exists. It stretches petroleum, and it has infrastructure already, so you can buy it. I mean, if you know, it's somewhere, you can get it. And... it's cheaper, really, now, and it's cheaper than gasoline now. It was like $1 a gallon more here not long ago, mm-hmm. and now I saw it for 40 cents a gallon less than gasoline. I think China is the answer there. They stopped importing and started exporting. But the wisdom out of that source of wisdom, Detroit, is that Americans will not buy diesel, and they're right because they don't have a chance to because there are not that many diesels made available. VW is very surprised that the TDI is doing so well. I mean, VW is the diesel guy, right? And there's quite like 35% of the Jettas are diesel, and they expected like 15 or something, but the market for diesel is not broad, but it is deep and intense. People who want diesel really, really want diesel. And that's how markets are built, by people who are really keen on a product. And their neighbors then learn keenness from them. In fact, I think it might be worthwhile to send a whole bunch of people to Europe to rent diesels because they all come home and say, why can't we get cars like that here?
Of course, the big problem is our emission standards. You know, as you know, a typical Mercedes application adds about $4,000 of emissions equipment on top of an engine that already costs more. And Mercedes don't charge the customer for that. They're eating most of that cost. But
yeah,
what I don't get is why don't we just declare a diesel emission moratorium in the United States and say, hey, look, if you meet the European standards, Western European standards, that's good enough for us. For the next 5 years, come on in, bring your diesels with you, and you can sell them in this country. And guess what? People are not going to be grabbing their throats and choking and falling over dead from the pollution.
Because the tree huggers won't embrace it.
They don't want it.
No, even though it's the answer, it is, as Denise said, an interim answer. 25 to 35% better fuel economy.
And less CO2.
Oh.
That you'd think the environmentalists would jump at.
And better torque.
Oh.
I mean, really what drivers want is torque and range. And they don't know that because they don't know those words. But if you say, well, did anybody talk about car having good pickup, that's torque. So, oh, yeah, I like that. You get across the intersection, you get up the ramp, you get past the 18-wheeler. Torque, that low-end torque, makes you think you're really, really powerful. And then, as a result of your good mileage, you get long range. Nobody I know likes to stop at gas stations. My daddy used to wean every car we had. I swear we ran out of gas more than our share of times. But stopping for fuel is just not the happiest thing in the world to do. And that's why ethanol will never be really a success in flex fuel vehicles, because you stop so much more often than you do on gasoline. So those two things, torque and range and a nice turning circle, that's all you need.
This is why PR people that I know and journalists like you guys love you, Denise. You are a chick that talks cars. I mean, how many women do you know talk about torque?
Peter, what do you think?
Well, the thing about diesel, I can remember the first diesel I had to test was a Peugeot diesel. I was living in Vermont then, and that thing would not get out of its own way. It could not make up a hill at all, and I couldn't pull the skin off a rice pudding. You know, just powerless. And it sounded like a spoon down the disposal. You know, it was just that awful noise and smell and all of those things. And I thought, God, this is a dreadful vehicle. Who would want diesel? Well, a lot of people are stuck in that memory. And what has happened is turbo, lower sulfur fuel, and engine management chips and things. And those things make diesel a pleasure to drive. It's quiet. I mean, I was at VIR for the VW's TDI racing series. The things you kept hitting your head as cars went by, because where was the noise? Something's wrong here. They're very quiet, very clean. At Le Mans, when Audi first was winning there, Gemini, you just could not believe this whisper car going by. So all of the prejudices are wrong. I mean, things have been changed. And, of course, even with the emissions, NOx is visible most of the time. So you get a bad rap. And so CARB in California made NOx the real villain instead of CO2. Which is really more of a more problem in global warming than anything. And gasoline engines are inherently worse on CO2, and diesel is really bad on NOx, but they just have fallen into that focus group intelligence that says Americans won't buy diesel. I mean, have they ever heard of selling? You know, you make it available to people, and you let them try it, and they get incredible mileage and have this wonderful performance. And, I mean, yes, it costs more. It lasts longer. The other thing is that even if you, say, turn your car in every 3 years or whatever, a nice diesel lasts longer. I mean, not only for you, but for the next buyer and the next owner and the next owner and on down the line. And that's pretty green to have a car last through a whole lot of owners.
Peter, what do you think? Diesels, what's your view? Are they going to make it or in this market or no?
Well, they're so sophisticated now. And, you know, of course, I like the racing angle of Le Mans with Audi and Peugeot. The new contemporary diesels are worthy of consideration, but I don't know what's going to get the American public to start slowly going. I used to think it would be the enthusiasts who would lead the charge, but you know, it just seems to go to a certain level and just stops. And every time, you know, a new diesel is introduced from, you know, Mercedes or Peugeot or Volkswagen in Europe, and we read all the wonderful glowing reviews about it, and then Audi, you know, they'll bring a diesel over here or something like that, Mercedes, and they're all wonderful, but we just can't seem to get people to get over the hump.
We spend zero marketing dollars on diesel.
Yeah.
We don't tell people.
It needs marketing, and also it needs everyone's all so expensive. Now, what they need is the approach that Toyota did with Prius. Nobody knew how much they were paying for a hybrid because there was no non-hybrid Prius. You go into a Honda store, there's a car with a Civic that is a plain Civic and a Civic that's a hybrid, and people compare the price and see that they were paying a lot more. So, but with the Prius, it had things like remote opening and a few little sort of high level items, and everyone thought it was a nice car. They didn't notice that it had drum brakes in the back, but the whole things that made people think their car was worth money was there, and they had no way to compare it. So to them, it was an inexpensive car. Now, if you can do the same thing with diesel to a degree.
That's funny, because Saturn used a View hybrid as a way to sell the regular View. You're going to spend $4,000 more for this car.
Right.
And you may recover the cost if you own the car for 10 years. With a diesel, you recover the cost every frickin' mile you go. So,
Well, I think it's just a matter of we need more selection. I mean, you know, Mercedes was here 2 years ago. Now BMW, Audi, Volkswagen have diesels. As they offer more, you know, first you can only get V6s in expensive cars. Now Volkswagen's got fours in cars that most people can afford. And I think it's just a matter of exposing people to it. But, you know, something's got to be done about the diesel fuel price. Yeah, it's cheaper than gasoline right now, but I'm sure at some point in the next year it's going to be more than gasoline again, because it always goes through this wild fluctuation.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. It's the oil companies. I do believe that diesel will catch on in this country as it did in Europe. They expected to catch on in Europe like it did. I mean, 10 years ago, diesel was pretty much the same place in Europe that it is here. Well, maybe 12, 13 years ago. And then all of a sudden it took off. And it took off because of high-level performance cars, because of the range. A head of Mercedes in Rome told me that the reason executives liked diesel cars was that they could go from Milano to Roma and back without having to stop for fuel, and thus opening themselves the possibility of a carjacking. So it's a safety measure. You don't have to stop for fuel.
Well, what changed it all, of course, was what you were talking about earlier, common rail, direct injection, turbocharging, and that transforms a diesel engine. And then, as you know, in Europe, they deliberately price diesel, or until recently, certainly, have priced, taxed diesel fuel at a lot lower rate than gasoline.
Yes, because they use taxation as an incentive to make people buy cars that use less fuel, and they taxed big cars, so everybody bought tiny cars, small cars. That's why small cars are popular in Europe and have never really hit big here. But I think that you can conceal the cost of adoption in a car by what I call homogenizing the value, and that is putting a lot of expensive things on it that you don't charge for, because you just charge cost, because a lot of accessories have terrific markup, leather, for instance, and sunroofs and all that stuff. But if you hide the cost by charging just barely cover it, then it looks like they're getting a good deal, a really high-grade individual car. And you also make it an owner experience, an ownership experience. You give people hats and give them gatherings and create like Saturn did, like Miata did. It's a club, a diesel club.
Hey, Peter, along those lines, of getting more fuel efficiency and the like. Buick announced on Monday that the new LaCrosse is going to be available with a four-cylinder engine. Talk a little bit about what you think of what they're doing with the LaCrosse there.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, let's go back to the new Malibu, because I think the new Malibu with the four-cylinder and the six-speed automatic is a better car than the bigger engine car.
And I agree.
It'll be interesting to see how this LaCrosse goes, because the mileage is quite good. And I actually, on the way over here, I was driving next to a LaCrosse. Someone from GM was driving it home. And I don't know. It'll be interesting, because I think the American consumer public a year ago, when gas was really expensive, you know, all of a sudden they investigated. You know, the four-cylinder, six-speed Malibu was late in getting to the market, but when it got to the market, people drove them, and they said, you know what, this around town, this is pretty damn good. So I don't know if they're going to translate that with the LaCrosse or not. That's going to be an interesting experiment. I think for a lot of people, though, who just drive around town, I think it'd be an interesting choice, don't you?
And nothing like a good little old four-banger, really. I mean,
if you got the right gearbox, if you got the right gearbox with it, you know, they can
absolutely. You put a manual, and the steering on that Malibu is better in the four-banger, because it's not the electric steering; it's a mechanical steering, and it feels better. And I tell you, the last time I enjoyed driving a Camry was an introduction where they had a four-banger with a manual transmission, and I had a ball with that car, and I thought, you know, chiminy, old. Then I started thinking what you could do with it, you know, all of this stuff. And you don't usually, I don't know, I just don't feel that way about a V6. I don't, it's already finished.
The thing about Buick, though, John, is, you know, I had an opportunity to see Buicks out, what's coming, and boy, their design is going to be spectacular. Now, I don't know. A really striking visual look for Buick is about to unfold for us, and I think it's going to surprise some people. But, you know, I don't know if people in this market will equate the four-cylinder like, oh, well, I don't want that. That car's too big for that motor.
Well, my question is, I mean, the V6 version of the LaCrosse is nearly 4,000 pounds.
Right.
And this 2.4-liter engine that they're going to put in with the six-speed automatic will have, if I remember right, I think it was 182 horsepower.
Yeah.
That suggests to me this is going to be kind of a pokey car.
Yeah. Well,
unless they take the weight out substantially.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about it.
Most people that buy cars in the United States have never been in Europe, so they don't know what it's like to have a little bit underpowered engine with pretty good torque, but still underpowered. So they don't want that. So,
well, they will want it if and when gas goes back to $4 a gallon. Then they'll be willing to compromise.
I've said it relentlessly. If this country has a bottom that doesn't change on the price of fuel, that would do more to change the nation's fleet than any CAFE standard. And we found that out a year ago. All of a sudden, you know, that was the beginning of the end for Detroit. All of a sudden, their profit center was just eradicated because people said, you know, I can't really spend $85 a week to fill up my vehicle, so I got to make a different choice. But if this country, if we know over a three-year phase-in that the bottom of the cheapest price of gasoline is going to be, you know, $3 the first year, $3.50 the second year, $4 the third year, you'll see people changing their attitude.
Who was the first CEO to call for a gas tax?
Probably Iacocca.
Yes, he was. He said, you want to change America's tastes, do it this way.
And Alan Mulally, not long after he got into town, said the same thing.
Right.
And you're a heretic when you say that. Oh, my God, what a bastard you are. But the fact is, you want to change the car park, change the price of fuel.
Well, like you
no,
guys.
That's it. That's the thing. When gas was in the 70-cent range, I said gas should be taxed so it would be always $1.50 a gallon and wouldn't fluctuate. And you would just have the any fluctuations take place within that $0.70 to $1.50 range. But then when I got to New Mexico and they had a 6% gas tax, and a governor ran on doing away with the gas tax, and he was elected. He did away with the gas tax, and the next day gasoline rose 6%, oddly enough. So I think that there's possible manipulation somewhere. My nephew, who is a petrol engineer, he says it's impossible because if they even mention pricing among themselves, there's someone overhearing it, and there'll be a lawsuit. So he said it's impossible, and he laughed at me when I said they're affecting the diesel price in the same way. They're manipulating it, and he said, oh, that's not true, not true. But I think they're finding a way of doing it.
Well, I think there's no question that speculators, especially last year, got involved and started bidding up the price of oil as an investment mechanism. And I say speculators. I mean, pension funds were getting in it. Mutual funds were making plays like this. And I think one of the reasons we've just seen oil go up recently is the speculators are trying to test the price again.
And any financial advisor right now to any individual with any money is saying, put some money in oil. Your money is safe.
Well, I think there's no question that when the world economy recovers, we are going to see the price of oil go up and go up substantially. You know, everyone I talk to in the industry who follows this is saying it's going to settle in minimum somewhere between $80 and $100 a barrel. And if the world economy really comes back, we're going to see it spike up to $140 a barrel like we did last year.
Well, the Detroit car companies based all their car development in the last 18 months on $3.50 a gallon minimum price of fuel. So,
and what is it in Italy? $6-$8 a gallon?
Right.
Denise? Oof. Yeah, it's that way in France, and we're still in the lap of luxury right here.
Right.
Paying nothing.
Right. Hey, Jason, let's get into another topic here, too. Last night, the president signed the Cash for Clunkers bill. You think that's going to do much for the industry?
Well, it's so limited on what it can do, how many cars
Isn't there a total dollar amount?
Total dollar amount, how long you had to have your
billion?
Car.
Yeah.
$1 billion. It's not an open-ended thing. If it was open-ended, it would be the mother load for the car industry.
Yeah.
But it is close-ended, and so it'll have a blip. I could see, really, car sales if... It's not the Senate yet, is it?
Or
is
no, it's law.
It's law.
It was law as of last night.
Okay, all right. I can see car sales not in June, but in July, jump about 10% compared to last year. It'll be up for the first month in the last, year and a half?
Yeah, something like that.
And it'll last for maybe 2 or 3 months, and then all that will suck all the oxygen out of the air.
And it ends October 1st?
Yeah.
Oh, and Ben's got a website up on the screen right now, too. It's cars.gov, cars.gov. It's a government website where you can learn everything that you would possibly want to know about Cash for Clunkers.
You know, in Germany, for instance, I think the sales were up like 40%.
Yeah, it was a big jump.
It was huge. But it was
China's got a program going. China sales are going strong.
So, but this is so limited, it's a wallpaper, really.
Yeah. My clunker doesn't even qualify.
You're right.
It's too old.
It's over 25 years old.
Nope. I thought it's a 93.
That qualifies. Your car has to be more than 8 years old, but not more than 25. More than 25 was because the classic car guys got a hold of who's ever writing the legislation and said, are you nuts? You know, we don't want to get rid of those cars. We want to save them for posterity.
Yeah. But that's the thing is I think everything has to be crushed, huh? I mean, block and all.
Yeah, I don't know the fine details of that, but you're right. The car does have to be scrapped.
They're trying to do several things here. They're trying to get, you know, old gas guzzlers off the road, and they're trying to spark car sales, and they're trying to stimulate employment, all with this thing.
Well, then to stimulate employment, they should hire people to take those clunkers apart and save some of the parts
recycle.
Useful, you know.
And make artwork out of them in Santa Fe.
Yeah, right. You could line them up in the flea market and sell little bits and pieces. They could make jewelry out of connecting rods or something, you know.
This is a little tiny scratch on the surface. This is not the European model, and it'll have a limited effect.
Peter, what do you think?
It wasn't even like the original bill that the people who started the thing didn't even recognize the finished bill. So,
that's a shock. It's funny how that works.
Yeah.
Jason, one of the topics I think you sent me this that you wanted to get into, or no, Peter, you sent this of Chrysler mulling whether or not it should do a.
Well, that was our AE. It was just like
one of your rants.
Well, no, it's on the table. It's just a headline on page one. You know, I know Jason. I'd like to see Chrysler do well too. But when I saw that headline on the front of Automotive News that they're just mulling over a midsize, it's just like, oh, guys.
Yeah, whether or not they should do a midsize
or how they're going to do. I mean, oh boy. I mean, we're talking 2015. If they're still. Well, what do you guys think? I mean, it's...
Mulling is not a good word.
Yeah. Mulling is not good.
Not good.
But they've got this beautiful concept car, the 200C. I think that thing looks dynamite. Well, why not just put a chassis and an engine under that body and get it in the showroom?
That's what they're talking about. But the problem is they're talking about it. They're mulling it. I mean, even GM has a plan. Ford's well down the road on their plans, so boy, they've got, you know, talk about double time, triple time. They can't move fast enough.
Chrysler's product development has been emaciated. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if I hope they can kickstart it. But it's a hollow thing right now. And so you're right, mulling something like that, they should be a year away from a midsize car because the Sebring and Avenger has been a disaster in the marketplace for 3 years now. So 2 years ago, you should have been saying, how are we going to get to the next model? You're mulling.
Yeah,
that's not
that's
good.
What you do to wine. That's not what you do to cars.
So, I mean, that's the big question about Chrysler now. Can they survive? Peter's talked about it on his website.
Long enough
for Fiat to get here. And when Fiat gets here, is it just Fiat North America? I read your crap.
And it's crap.
Bloody.
They've got the Grand Cherokee coming. They got a 300. Both are going to be good, very good. Is it enough?
But they need a mainstream.
The heart of the market, never been successful, never.
Yeah, they really need a mainstream.
And now mulling.
Well, like I said, this.
What alphas are they bringing?
That's about it.
No, the alpha, I thought the first model they're bringing in is the 159.
Not the Fiat 500?
Oh, the
Alfa is going to be the luxury brand.
Right. But I'm saying, yeah, the 500's coming, and now they're going to build it in Toluca, Mexico, which totally surprises me. They're not going to import it from Italy. Or Italy, what do I mean? It's actually made in Poland.
Right.
But they're going to build it in Toluca, which surprises me big time. And they're talking about putting the Alfa 169 on the chassis of the Chrysler 300, and building that in Canada, which I find fascinating.
Well, first of all, the Toluca plant in Mexico is an awesome plant.
Very high-quality plant.
Incredibly high quality. You know, it's one thing that VW never figured out, how to make Mexican facilities work really good.
Although Ford's facility in Mexico that makes the Fusion Milan and MKZ, that's a good plant.
I've been
to that place.
So they pay their...
And Nissan's got a good plant in Mexico,
Nissan was the second manufacturer in Mexico. 60-some years ago. And so they've got it down. Chrysler really has it down in Mexico. And they build high-quality vehicles down there, whether it was the PT Cruiser or the Ram. And they pay their workers a lot for local wages. And but let's see where they go with all this stuff.
Well, they got a, as we've talked about on this program before, they got a big hole in their product lineup for the next 2 years. I mean, what you see now is what you're going to see 2 years from now. They don't have anything new coming, really.
Which is kind of funny because up until 6 months ago, they were all talking about how they have 24 new products in the next 2 years. Boy, where did that go?
Well, we talked about it. I mean, all the media people I know are kind of looking at their watches like, really? Where are they? Show us, please.
Really?
Yeah. Yes, really.
Right. Well, really? You know what they, and all automakers have done this, not just Chrysler, but, you know, they slap a decal on it and they call it a special edition something, and that's a new model. That gets counted as one of the 24.
Yeah, but Jim Press was out there saying we got 24 new models.
Yeah, he was. I mean, a lot.
Yeah, a lot.
Right.
And then suddenly the task force came in and said, you have four. And now it's two or three. So I pray for them. You know I do.
Denise, what do you think of Chrysler's prospects?
They have an interesting past. The Jeep, it depends on what the Jeep, I think, has always been one of their main hopes. And those have been, I don't know, the four-door little four-door Wrangler, whatever it is, seems nice. In actual fact, you know, the Hummer 3 was a better off-road vehicle than the Jeep. I drove them over the Rubicon, one each, within 2 weeks of each other, and the Hummer 3 did a better job, an easier job than the Jeep. And so I'm not sure of what... but then, you know, how many people drive off-road?
Yeah,
I mean, intentionally.
I'll argue with you on that. I think the Hummer brand is so dead because it's so politically incorrect right now to drive a Hummer.
Oh, yeah. You've got to know the words. You can't just hum them. Yeah. The thing is, it was like years ago when I first came to Santa Fe, the Range Rover was the car of gated communities, which were not looked upon kindly here necessarily. And the cars were just, the word was spit out. Nobody actually said it. They just spit it. And the cars were, they were keyed in the park downtown and so forth. And it's funny how people who really don't know the names of many cars learn one and hate it, and that's the way it is with the Hummer to a great degree. And it's too bad because, in actual fact, if you like driving off-road, and of course it was no different from the pickup it was built on, it got 20 miles per gallon, but reason doesn't have anything to do with it. The name was a guess, and it's gone. But Jeep has some work to do, I think.
Well, I'll say this for them. I know they've got a new interior coming in. I think it's the current Grand Cherokee. And then they've shown what the next generation of Grand Cherokee is going to look like. And when I first saw the pictures, I thought, well, this is just a mild facelift. But I got a good look at the concept vehicle this past Sunday at the Eyes on Design event. That is a terrific looking Grand Cherokee.
That's great.
And
what's terrific.
Surprising to me is they've kept all the head hard points exactly the same. And it's just Ralph Gilles has gotten in there and worked his magic on the exterior. I can't believe how much more sophisticated the design looks. Even though the headlamps are in the exact same position, the door handles are the same position, not that they look the same. Same with the tail lamps. All the dimensions are the same. And yet it looks like this vehicle just looks way more sophisticated and expensive.
It's funny. This vehicle redefined the segment. It was so cool, and it really saved Chrysler in the 90s and got Chrysler on an uphill track. the last iteration was a disaster.
Yep.
Because it took the, it had a softer feel before, softer look, great lines, and it suddenly looked like all the Japanese entrants.
Well, I asked one, and I can't remember the guy's name who designed that vehicle, and I said, what's going on here? I mean, it doesn't look as good as the old one. And he said, what you're looking at is a vehicle that was halfway through its design when Daimler took over, and then they came in and made all these changes. So what you see is sort of a hodgepodge of really a second-half design that was rushed to market and was done under the diktat of the Germans of saying, this is how the headlamps are going to look. That's what he told me.
Partially true. But it was a U.S. design staff, so let's don't blame it on the Germans. They were going for a different look, and they blew it. But this is a vehicle that should be on its own. It's a perfect size. Mm-hmm. It's not a big SUV. It's nimble and so forth. It's a five-passenger vehicle, period. Well, not really. It's a
great four-passenger vehicle.
Yeah. So, and a perfect two-passenger vehicle. But
sounds like...
Go ahead, Denise.
Sounds like a great prospect for a diesel engine.
Oh, and but the problem is they got the Blue Tech diesel from the Germans, which was $7,000. The Germans were charging them for it. But it is the perfect vehicle to get a Fiat diesel engine in it.
Oh, wow.
That gets, you know, 35 miles per gallon, goes on the Rubicon, takes you to school, takes you to the theater. It is the quintessential awesome Jeep.
That sounds great.
It is awesome.
Are we doing rapid fire now?
Yeah. No.
We got
to
get
rapid fire questions.
I've seen
out
several
here.
People in the Detroit area with their Wranglers with their doors off driving down the street. You are stupid. That's for off-road.
Yeah. I saw that today, matter of fact.
I bet you did. And I've seen two or three with kids in them. Put the doors on the damn vehicle when you're driving down the road, telegraph or whatever on the highway. They are protection. If you want to go off-road when you're going 5 miles per hour, like you and I did, Denise, in Arkansas many years ago, when you're creeping along, that's okay. Put the damn doors on the vehicle.
JeepExtremist.com.
I mean, it just... I'm sitting there in traffic going, looking at a mother with her kids in the car going, you are retarded. Come on. These doors offer protection. Do we have a rapid fire chip?
We do. Do you want to talk suppliers but quickly? Or
no. Let's save it for next week.
Let's save it for next week.
Because let's get into rapid fire. Yeah. We got to bring the graphic up.
I'm glad.
Okay. Denise, you know the protocol here? Jason's going to read comments and questions, and we get less than a minute to answer them. So, Jason, okay. Go ahead.
Okay, from our favorite, Bald Sack, on Twitter asks, how does Peter like the new Prius ads on TV?
I wrote about that 3 weeks ago and on the table, the shiny, happy... smiley spot with the shiny, happy, smiley people making up the actual environment, which was a total ripoff of the Olympic Games. And I think it's appropriate for who they're going after. It's not, certainly not my favorite. It's just too precious for me.
I'll give you one other insight. My daughter, who's 20 years old, says those ads just creep me out.
Yeah, they are pretty creepy. But you know, I've been, you know, probably appropriately branded as an anti-Toyota person. But I just there's a cynicism that underlies those spots. There's a cynicism that underlies all of the Prius marketing that just drives me crazy. And I don't like it.
Denise?
Yeah. As I refer to them as a smuggery of Prius owners.
Yeah.
Okay, next one, Jason.
This is from Doug Stokes from Azusa, California. And he asks, Denise, will you marry me?
Well, of course. How old are you?
Send us more info, please.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And a picture.
And a picture, yeah, of you. Yeah.
Of your bank account.
Yeah.
No, your car.
Mudmonster37, a constant viewer, asks, what diesel car would... Well, he can't write. What diesel car would like in the States? What diesel car would you like in the States? I think he's what he's meaning to say. Hey, Mudmonster, go back to college. What diesel
car? I would like a Suzuki SX4 with a Peugeot diesel in it.
That'd be a great combination. You can get it in all-wheel
drive.
They've
got it, but they won't bring it.
Not here. I like what you were talking about earlier, Jason. I think a Grand Cherokee with a diesel that gets 35 miles to the gallon and great gobs of power. But I don't want to pay, you know, through the nose to get an engine like that.
I'd willing be to pay $3,000, not six or five. Richard Eaton from Searcy, Arkansas, just down the road from my dad's hometown in Grubbs, Arkansas. Hello, Richard. Why would Tesla, who wants to build electric cars for almost $100,000, need a loan from the U.S. government? Peter.
Well, because they're, as we said, they're connected. It's politically correct. It's the whole California shiny, happy, green world out there that's really, you know, got the Obama administration in a headlock. And they're throwing a frickin' bone to Tesla.
Throw me a frickin' bone. I'm the boss. Yeah. Need the info.
Well, this is where having the Speaker of the House from your home state and what's Henry Waxman's committee?
Energy and Commerce.
Energy and Commerce. So when you're looking for money and your senator and your congressman are those two, that explains how they got that money.
By the way, if you're near Google, Google Henry Waxman, and then Google the 20s horror movie Nosferatu. And you will realize that they were indeed separated at birth.
All right.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
And also, Henry Waxman is shorter than that camera.
All right, we're empty on this one. We go to the next one. Tucker asks, where are, Tucker, all the clunker scraps going? China?
No, they'll stay here in this country.
There
is a provision, and because this was brought up just like you raised the issue there, Peter, people are saying, wait a minute, there's good parts in those cars. You don't just want to crush good parts.
Well, good parts and good scrap metal, too.
Right. But in any case, there's a provision that the parts can be not crushed but recycled.
Yeah.
Okay, Pedro Fernandez asks, why do you report on cars we're never going to see here? It just seems frustrating.
Well, I know what Pedro's talking about because, you know, with our daily show, we always talk about the global automotive industry. And I feel that if you really want to be on top of what's going on in this industry, you got to pay attention to everything that's going on in the global industry.
Yeah, because platforms used in Asia, you know, there's a connection now.
Right. Yeah. And stuff that we see in overseas markets sometimes ends up here. But I share your frustration, Pedro. There is some cool stuff out there that we don't get our hands on here.
Oh, boy, is there.
Yeah.
Denise, you got something to add on that one?
The thing is you have to know what's available in Europe and other places so you can know how badly deprived you are.
GoatRope7 asks, Denise, has technology taken the fun out of cars? ABS, traction control, paddle shift, automatic transmissions, and all the other advances have really dumbed down the skill level required to drive a car smoothly and quickly. Most drivers today have never used a choke. Haven't we lost something along the way? And I want to acknowledge that GoatRope is celebrating his 120th birthday today. Denise?
We've lost a lot and we've gained a lot. It's just how you use it. It's a different tool, and most of the things you can use them to make driving even more fun if you use them properly. It makes driving transparent to the experience so that the car doesn't get in the way of the driving experience. Now, some people prefer so-called character in a car, clutch that slips and a gear that doesn't work quite right or isn't spaced properly. But I remember the discussion with Phil Hill one time about the NSX because people were complaining that it made driving too easy. And Phil said, that's preposterous, you know, that you you got a purer driving experience out of it. But so it's different, that's all.
You know,
I still like the, you know, double clutch and all those things. And,
I've got a great brief, very brief, great Phil Hill story. Eric Dalquist, who, I don't know if you know.
I know Eric, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, he, as a favor, he asked me to pick Phil Hill up from Metro Airport in Detroit and deposit him at an appearance or something. And I had just discovered Rain-X. Denise, you'll like this story. So I pick up Phil, and it was on a summer night like this, but it was dark. And I just discovered Rain-X, and I'd been using it for a couple months, and I just put a fresh coat. I was driving in one of those Audi GT coupes. You know, they were underpowered, but they looked good. And, you know, we're driving up 275, and, you know, I didn't know Phil. I found him, introduced myself, and, you know, he was one of my heroes. Here's Phil Hill riding next to me. And we're driving up, and it's pitch black on 275. There are no lights. It's freeway in Detroit for the viewers out there. And all of a sudden, you know, it's a torrential rain, except with fresh Rain-X.
On the windshield.
On the windshield. I don't put my wipers on. And Phil just about jumps out of his seat. What the hell is that? And I said, it's hard rain. He said, well, why aren't you using your wipers? Or better yet, why can't I see? You know. And, and I explained. He said, oh, if I had that at Le Mans, boy, it was priceless. I mean, I knew Denise would get a kick out of that. But
yeah,
that was Phil's first exposure to Rain-X. He just thought, why didn't they invent that when I was running in the rain and on the Mulsanne, you know? It was cool.
All right, Ronald Wright writes, given $30,000, what car would you buy? Start with you, Denise.
Well, if I could get that diesel SX4, and that's only about $18,000, so I've got for another whole car. I don't know. I like a Mini Clubman with a diesel. Do you think I've got one note here?
What would you get, John?
Boy, what would I get for $30,000? I don't know. I'm afraid the car I really want, or the kind of car I really want, is probably going to be more than $30,000. But
the question is, given $30,000, what car would you buy? Jesus.
What would I buy? God, that's...
You should run healthcare in this country.
Yeah.
All right, $30,000. What do you want to buy?
Oh, God. What would I buy? I'd buy a Pontiac G8.
G8. You can get one for $30,000?
Nice car.
Yeah, at a deal.
Right now, I think you could.
Okay. I'd get an Altima loaded.
I would get either the G8 or a Mustang GT with a little discount.
I take that back. I'd get a Jeep Wrangler, my favorite car.
I thought you had a Jeep Wrangler.
I had one.
Oh, okay. You'd get another one.
I'd get one, and I'd get it somewhat loaded, because the Sahara is about 34.
Mm-hmm. Or they were. I'll bet you. Oh, no, I bet you they're not discounting the Sahara.
Not too much. You could probably get one for 30, because I really believe, even though I see stupid people with the doors off, it is.
Jason, you know enough dealers. You could get a deal.
I could. Zoyle asked, Denise, how long do you keep your cars?
Well, my two-door sidekick is a 93. It's got about 40,000 miles on it. The thing is, we do tend to get some press cars, you know, so I don't put a lot of miles on any car, but I always like to have something I can go off-road in, so I keep it around. So Denise, I tend to keep them. I tend to keep them longer than most people.
So, Denise, speaking of press cars, and I know you love diesels and everything, but what car did you drive in the last year that, you know, I don't care if it was way out of your price range or whatever, but what car really turned you on that you drove in the last year just for the pure machine of it that you really loved?
Well, I like that the Nissan, the GTR, is that what they call
it? Yeah.
Well, because it's a two-tier car. I mean, you could just tootle around in it downtown and go to the grocery store, and then you say, and it really goes and turns it on.
Yeah.
So it's amazing. You don't need a sports car and a car. You got that.
Okay. I'm going to end with this one because this Dave Poole on Twitter asked us the last 3 weeks, and I'm finally going to give it to him. With the reported 212-day supply of Dodge Calibers, do you think anyone at Chrysler asked, why didn't we just improve the Neon?
Ooh, there's a good question.
It's a great question, and I'm sorry, Dave Poole on Twitter, that we didn't ask it before. Denise, should Chrysler just have improved on the Neon, or what do you think about the Caliber?
Well, I was very fond of the Neon because they made a kind of a little race car out of it. And my last race, indeed, was in a Neon, and a celebrity race in Detroit, as a matter of fact. But I don't know. I didn't object to the Caliber, but I think the Neon could have been developed more. It had a little longer life, I think, and a good name.
Peter?
I would have stayed with the Neon and developed it. I mean, there are things about the Caliber that aren't bad, but I thought the Neon name, they had something, and then kind of typical Detroit, they get something and then they walk away. They get a new idea and they walk away.
John?
Yeah. I think they should have just done a good job with the Caliber. I mean, obviously, this was a car that was designed to fit a budget. Of course, they all are, but the budget was set too low. And if it had had nicer interior materials, if they had put some mastic in the door panels so when that you slam the doors, it doesn't sound like a tin can, I think the car would have done a whole lot better. I actually like the styling of the Caliber. I think it's a good-looking car, especially in a gray or silver. I think the thing can pop. But because the interior, even though everything's crisply molded and nicely put together, it's just a sea of cheap plastic, and that's what killed them.
I have a unique perspective.
True.
I'll bet you do. Having worked at the company.
No, I drive a Caliber.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a black.
And
I drive a black RT. The beautiful thing is I can tell the condition of Michigan roads with my car because I hear everything. Poorly executed. I like the car. I love the styling. I like the interior except the plastic, but I like the utility of the car. But the road noise is terrible. The fuel economy is horrible for the size of car it is. But I go back to the Neon, and the Neon was a great idea when it came out, but the Neon was a piece of junk. It was just a piece of junk, and it got worse as time went on. It got cheapened and cheapened and cheapened, the espresso model and so forth.
It was never as good as the beautiful concept.
The first production cars were for what it was, but yet the car, for its size, had lousy fuel economy.
Yeah.
But you just said a key thing, Jason. When the car first came out, and remember, it was what? $7,500 or something? $8,500?
No, it was like $9,000.
Okay.
But it was under 10.
It was under 10. But all I'm saying is, for when it came out, it was a competitive car. And rather than make it better and better and better, to your point, they made it cheaper and cheaper and cheaper.
By the end of it, there was no content on it.
That's a classic, but that's one of the classic ways that Detroit got it wrong.
Yes.
You know, when a Japanese car company introduces a car,
they make it better and better and better.
They make it better and better and better. They don't stay in place. They keep making it better. Whereas Detroit, if they come out with something, it's anathema for them to just, okay,
squeeze.
It's just, they'll squeeze it instead of just make it better.
The last
refinement,
year.
Refinement. Add performance. add economy, add luxury, whatever you're going to do, but refine. If you believe in that, refine it. Detroit never got that.
The last year of the Neon was actually the Fred Flintstone edition, which it had no floorboards and you actually had no motor and you just went like this. But it was so sad because when that car came out, Business Week had it on its cover, "Can America Make a Small Car Profitably?" And it was cool looking. It was pretty close to the concept as far as the vision of the concept. And it was inexpensive and did well, but they cheapened it every model year. When the PT Cruiser came out, I was at Nissan at the time. I'd left Chrysler. The Nissan guys tore this car apart and go, "Holy cow, this is good."
Right.
It's amazing how inexpensively they built this car and how good it is.
Right.
But they cheapened it every year instead of making it better every year to take you into that next model year.
Yep. Exactly right.
And it's... Oh, we lost Denise. I hope not like Michael Jackson and Farrah Fawcett.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, it's time to get to the end of the show, but we got to show everybody this chart, Jason, because remember, we're having this contest to predict how long General Motors is going to stay in bankruptcy. I said 75 days. Peter said 77 days. Jason said 120 days. And Ben made up this really cool chart that shows... Everybody, and Jason can hold it up.
We already have the Biggest Loser.
Todd Augustini, you suck. You're out.
You're out. Todd's at the top of the chart here. He predicted under 25 days. We're now at what's today's date? The 25th?
Yes.
Yeah,
so we're still, Todd, you don't suck too much.
No, not too much.
But you still suck.
Right.
You know, this is the suck line.
Well, don't say he sucks, because by the time they come out of bankruptcy, he might be closer than you are.
I don't believe so, but we'll see.
We'll see.
There are more protests each and every day, and so I'm down, I'm right here, so I'm with the lower hanging fruit, but, and Peter, you're at 75?
77, John, 75.
You guys are right in the middle, kind of in the middle, you know, like, who cares?
So it's day 25.
Denise, you back?
Can you hear me?
We hear you.
Yeah, total systems failure here.
Well, hey, look, we're pushing the technological envelope. I keep telling people, this show is like television was in the late 40s and early 50s. We're pioneers here.
Well, anyway, I can hear you now, and... I don't know what happened.
Well, we're signing off in a minute. Wonderful to talk to you again. I can't wait to get back into a car driving around either a Jeep Jamboree in Arkansas with you or in a high-speed car.
Wouldn't that be fun?
You're my favorite, my friend.
Aren't you kind?
Thank you, Denise.
Yeah, Denise, thank you, guys.
Great,
terrific.
Great having you on here, especially talking about diesels, which I know is a personal passion of yours.
I do like them. Dr. Rudolph and I were close friends, you know.
Well, maybe that's what we should call the podcast version of the show, Dr. Rudolph.
Yeah.
Dr. Rudolph.
Or how about Win Diesel?
So thank everybody for having tuned in for this show. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/autoline. You can follow Peter with all his stuff at twitter.com/autoextremist. And Jason, we always talk about Forgotten Harvest, where you work at this point, too.
And by the way, we've seen contributions increase since we came on the show. We see it the night that I'm on. www.forgottenharvest.org. Give a buck, give 10 bucks, give 100 bucks.
Because you feed people.
We feed people. For every dollar you give, we feed 6 people tomorrow. We go out and rescue food from the grocery stores and the caterers and the farmers markets and the wholesalers, and we immediately, that same day, take it to the food agencies, the Salvation Armies, and so forth. If you don't live in the Detroit area, go online and find your food bank. There's a food bank in every community. and give a few dollars, because it goes so far. These are efficient organizations that buy food or gather food and give it to those people. And we have, unfortunately, too many people that are hungry, especially kids and elderly adults. So do what you can. A $10 contribution can feed a lot of people tomorrow. So do that for us.
Well said. And Denise, again, thanks for joining us. And Peter, Jason, great having you guys here every Thursday as we do. And thank all of you for having tuned in tonight.
It's great fun.
Visit our website, outerlinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Out of Line Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Out of Line Detroit. That's all there and much more at outerlinedetroit.tv.